An exposition of Psalm 130 by John Owen, answering the question, why is full assurance so rare in Christians? Or as John Owen puts it, the greatness and rareness of the discovery of forgiveness in God. What are the reasons of it? The testimonies of conscience and law, lies against it, and so on. This discovery a forgiveness in God is great, holy, and mysterious, and which very few on gospel grounds attain to. All men indeed say there is forgiveness with God. Most men are persuaded that they think so. Only men in great and desperate extremities, like Cain or Francis Spira, seem to call it into question. But their thoughts are empty, groundless, yea, for the most part wicked and atheistical. Elihu tells us that to declare this aright to a sinful soul, it is the work of a messenger, an interpreter, one among a thousand. Job 33, verse 23, that is, indeed, of Christ himself. The common thoughts of men about this thing are slight and foolish, may be resolved into those mentioned by the psalmist in Psalm 50, verse 21. They think that God is altogether such an one as themselves, that, indeed, he takes little or no care about these things, but passes them over as slightly as they do themselves, that notwithstanding all their pretenses, the most of men never had indeed any real discovery of forgiveness, shall be afterwards undeniably evinced. And I shall quickly show the difference that is between their vain credulity and a gracious gospel discovery of forgiveness in God. For it must be observed that by this discovery I intend both a revelation of it made by God and our understanding and reception of that revelation to our own advantage, as shall be shown now. Now, the grounds of the difficulty intimated consist partly in the hindrances that lie in the way of this discovery, and partly in the nature of the thing itself that is discovered, of both, which I shall briefly treat. But here, before I proceed, somewhat must be premised to show what it is that I particularly intend by a discovery of forgiveness. It may then be considered in two ways. One, for a doctrinal, objective discovery of it in its truth, or two, an experimental, subjective discovery of it in its power. In the first sense, forgiveness in God has been discovered ever since the giving out of the first promise. God revealed it in a word of promise, or it could never have been known. It shall be afterward declared. In this sense, after many lesser degrees and advancements of the light of it, it was fully and gloriously brought forth by the Lord Jesus Christ in his own person, and is now revealed and preached in the gospel, and by them to whom the word of reconciliation is committed. And to declare this as the principal work of the ministers of the gospel, in this are those unsearchable treasures and riches of Christ, which the apostle esteemed as his chiefest honor and privilege that he was entrusted with, the declaration and dispensation of it. Ephesians 3, verses 8 and 9. I know by many it is despised, by many traduced, whose ignorance and blindness is to be lamented. But the day is coming which will manifest every man's work of what sort it is. In a latter sense, how it is made by faith in the soul shall in its proper place be further opened and made known. Here many mistake and deceive themselves. Because it is so in the book, they think it is so in them also. Because they have been taught it, they think they believe it. But it is not so. They have not heard this voice of God at any time, nor seen his shape. It has not been revealed to them in its power. To have this done is a great work, for first, the constant voice of conscience lies against it. Conscience, if not seared, inexorably condemns and pronounces wrath and anger upon the soul that has the least guilt cleaving to it. Now, it has this advantage. It lies close to the soul, and by importunity and loud speaking it will be heard in what it has to say. It will make the whole soul attend, or it will speak like thunder, and its constant voice is that where there is guilt, there must be judgment. Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. Conscience naturally knows nothing of forgiveness, yea, it is against its very trust, work, and office to hear anything of it. If a man of courage and honesty be entrusted to keep a garrison against an enemy, let one come and tell him that there is peace made between those whom he serves and their enemies, so that he may leave his guard, and set open the gates, and cease his watchfulness, how wary will he be, lest under this pretense he be betrayed? No, he says, I will keep my old hold until I have express order from my superiors. Conscience is entrusted with the power of God in the soul of a sinner, with command to keep all in subjection with reference to the judgment to come. It will not betray his trust in believing every report of peace. No, but this it says, and it speaks in the name of God. Guilt and punishment are inseparable twins. If the soul sin, God will judge. What? Tell you me of forgiveness? I know what my commission is, and that I will abide by. You shall not bring in a superior commander, a cross principle into my trust, for if this be so, it seems I must let go of my throne. Another lord must come in, not knowing as yet how this whole business is compounded in the blood of Christ. Now, whom should a man believe if not his own conscience, which, as it will not flatter him, so it intends not to affright him, but to speak the truth as the manner requires? Conscience has two works in reference to sin, one to condemn the acts of sin, another to judge the person of the sinner, both with reference to the judgment of God. When forgiveness comes, it would sever in part these employments and take one of them out of the hand of conscience. It would divide the spoil with the strong one. It shall condemn the fact, or every sin, but it shall no more condemn the sinner. The person of the sinner, that, shall be freed from its sentence. Your conscience labors with all of its might to keep its whole dominion, and to keep out the power of forgiveness from being enthroned in the soul. It will allow men to talk of forgiveness, to hear it preached, though they abuse it every day, but to receive it in its power, that stands up in direct opposition to its dominion. In the kingdom, conscience says, I will be greater than you, and in many, and in the most, it keeps its possession, and will not be deposed. Nor indeed is it an easy work so to deal with it. The apostle tells us that all the sacrifices of the law could not do it. Hebrews 10 verse 2, they could not bring a man into that state in which he should have no more conscience of sin, that is, conscience condemning the person. For conscience, in a sense of sin, and condemnation of it is never to be taken away, and this can be no otherwise done but by the blood of Christ, as the apostle at large there declares. It is, then, no easy thing to make a discovery of forgiveness to a soul, when the work and employment which conscience upon unquestionable grounds challenges to itself lies in opposition to it. Hence, is the soul's great desire to establish its own righteousness, in which its natural principles may be preserved in their power. Let self-righteousness be enthroned, and natural conscience desires no more. It is satisfied and pacified. The law it knows, and righteousness it knows, but as forgiveness it says, what is this? To the utmost, until Christ perfects his conquest, there on this account secret strugglings in the heart against free pardon in the gospel, and fluctuations of mind and spirit about it. Yea, hence are the doubts and fears of believers themselves. They are nothing but the strivings of conscience to keep its whole dominion, to condemn the sinner as well as the sin, more or less. It keeps up its pretensions against the gospel while we live in this world. It is a great work that the blood of Christ has to do on the conscience of a sinner. For whereas it has been declared, it has a power and claims a right to condemn both the sin and the sinner. The one part of this, its power is to be cleared, strengthened, made more active, vigorous, and watchful. The other to be taken quite away. It shall now see more sins than formerly, more of the vileness of all sins than formerly, and condemn them with more abhorrency than ever, upon more and more glorious accounts than formerly. But it is also made to see an interposition between these sins and the person of the sinner who has committed them, which is no small or ordinary work. Secondly, the moral law lies against this discovery of forgiveness. The law is a beam of the holiness of God Himself. What it speaks to us, it speaks in the name and authority of God. And I shall briefly show concerning it these two things. One, that this is the voice of the law, namely, that there is no forgiveness for a sinner. Number two, that a sinner has great reason to give credit to the law in that assertion. One, it is certain that the law knows neither mercy nor forgiveness. The very sanction of it lies wholly against them. The soul that sins, it shall die. Cursed is he that continues not in all things in the book of the law to do them. Deuteronomy 27:26. Galatians 3:10. So the apostle pronounces universally, without exception, that they who are under the law are under the curse, Galatians 3:10, and he says in verse 12, the law is not of faith. There is an inconsistency between the law and believing. They cannot have their abode and power together. Do this and live. Fail to do this and you die. It's a constant, immutable voice of the law. This it speaks in general to all, and is in particular to every one. Number two, the sinner seems to have manifold and weighty reasons to attend to the voice of this law, and to acquiesce in its sentence. Four, the law is co-natural to him, his domestic, his old acquaintance. It came into the world with him and has grown up with him from his infancy. It was implanted in his heart by nature. Is his own reason. He can never shake it off or part with it. It is his familiar, his friend, that cleaves to him as a flesh to the bone, so that they who have not the law written cannot but show forth the work of the law, Romans 2:14-15, and that, because the law itself is inbred to them, and all the faculties of the soul are at peace with it, are in subjection to it. It is a bond and ligament of their union, harmony, and correspondency among themselves in all their moral acting. It gives life, order, motion to them all. Now the gospel that comes to control the sentence of the law and to relieve the sinner from it is foreign to his nature, a strange thing to him, a thing he has no acquaintance or familiarity with. It has not been bred up with him, nor is there anything in him to side with it, to make a party for it, or to plead in its behalf. Now, shall not a man rather believe a domestic, a friend, indeed himself, than a foreigner, a stranger, that comes with uncouth principles, and such a suit not its reason at all, 1 Corinthians 1:18. Number two, the law speaks nothing to a sinner but what his conscience assures him to be true. There is a constant concurrence in the testimony of the law and conscience. When the law says, this or that is a sin worthy of death, conscience says, it is even so, Romans 1:32. And where the law of itself, as being a general rule, rests, conscience helps it on and says, this and that sin, so worthy of death, is the soul guilty of. Then die, saith the law, because you deserve it. Now, this must needs have a mighty efficacy to prevail with the soul to give credit to the report and testimony of the law. It speaks not one word, but what he has a witness within himself to the truth of it. These witnesses always agree, and so it seems to be established for a truth. There is no forgiveness. Number two, the moral law, though it speak against the soul's interest, yet it speaks nothing but what is so just, righteous, and equal, that it even forces the soul's consent. So Paul tells us, do men know this voice of the law to be the judgment of God? Romans 1, verse 32. They know it, and cannot but consent to it, that it is the judgment of God. That is, good, righteous, equal, not to be controlled. And indeed, what could be more righteous than its sentence? It commands obedience to the God of life and death, promises a reward, and declares that for non-performance of duty, death will be inflicted. On these terms, a sinner comes into the world. They are good, righteous, holy. The soul accepts of them, and doesn't know what it can desire better or more equal. This the apostle insists upon in chapter 7, verses 12 and 13. Wherefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy and just and good. Was in that which was good made death to me? God forbid. But sin, that it might appear sin, working death in me by that which is good, that sin by the commandment might become exceeding sinful. Wherever the blame falls, the soul cannot but acquit the law, and confess that what it says is righteous and uncontrollably equal, and it is meet things should be so. Now, though the authority and credit of a witness may go very far in a doubtful manner, when there is a concurrence of more witnesses, it strengthens the testimony. But nothing is so prevalent to beget belief as when the things themselves that are spoken are just and good, not liable to any reasonable exception. And so is it in this case, to the authority of the law and concurrence of conscience. This also is added, the reasonableness and equity of the thing itself proposed, even in the judgment of the sinner, namely, that every sin shall be punished, and every transgression receive a just recompense of reward. But yet further, what the moral law says, it speaks in the name and authority of God. What it says, then, must be believed, or we make God a liar. It doesn't come in its own name, but it comes in the name of Him who appointed it. You will say, then, is it so indeed? Is there no forgiveness with God? For this is a constant voice of the moral law, which you say speaks in the name and authority of God, and is therefore to be believed. I answer briefly with the apostle, what the law speaks, it speaks to them that are under the law. It does not speak to them that are in Christ, whom the law of the Spirit of life has set free from the law of sin and death. But to them that are under the law, it speaks, and it speaks the very truth, and it speaks in the name of God, and His testimony is to be received. It says there is no forgiveness in God, namely to them that are under the law, and they that shall flatter themselves with a contrary persuasion will find themselves woefully mistaken at the great day. On these and the like considerations, I say, there seems to be a great deal of reason why a soul should conclude that it will be according to the testimony of the law, and that he shall not find forgiveness. Law and conscience close together and insinuate themselves into the thoughts, mind, and judgment of a sinner. They strengthen the testimony of one another and greatly prevail. If any are otherwise minded, I leave them to the trial. If ever God awakened their consciences to a thorough performance of their duty, if He ever opens their souls and lets in the light and power of the law upon them, they will find it no small work to grapple with them. I am sure that eventually they prevail so far that in the preaching of the gospel we have great cause to say, Lord, who has believed our report? We come with a report of forgiveness. But who believes it? By whom is it received? Neither does light, nor conscience, nor conversation of the most allow us to suppose it is embraced. Thirdly, the engrafted notions that are in the minds of men concerning the nature and justice of God lie against this discovery of forgiveness also. There are in all men by nature indelible characters of the holiness and purity of God, of His justice and hatred of sin, of His invariable righteousness and the government of the world, that they can neither depose nor lay aside. For notions of God whatever they are, will bear sway and rule in the heart when things are put to the trial. They were in the heathen of old. They abode with him in all their darkness, as might be manifested by innumerable examples. But so it is in all men by nature. Their inward thought is that God is an avenger of sin, that it belongs to his rule and government of the world, his holiness and righteousness, to take care that every sin be punished. This is his judgment, which all men know, as was observed before, Romans 1, verse 32. They know that it is a righteous thing with God to render tribulation to sinners. From this is that dread and fear which surprises men at an apprehension of the presence of God, or of anything under him, above them, that may seem to come on his errand. This notion of God's avenging all sin exerts itself secretly, but effectually. So Adam trembled, and hid himself. And it was the saying of old, I have seen God, and shall die. When men are under any dreadful providence, thunder, lightning, tempest, and darkness, they tremble. Not so much at what they see or hear or feel, as from their secret thoughts that God is near, and that he is a consuming fire. Now these inbred notions are universally against all apprehensions of forgiveness, which must be brought into the soul from without doors, having no principle of nature to promote them. It is true, men by nature have presumptions and common and crafted notions of other properties of God besides his holiness and justice, as of his goodness, benignity, love of his creatures, and the like. But all these have this supposition inlaid with them in the souls of men, namely, that all things stand between God and his creatures as they did at their first creation, and as they have no natural notion of forgiveness, so the interposition of sin weakens, disturbs, darkens them. Any improvement of those apprehensions of goodness and benignity which they have, if they have any notion of forgiveness, it is from some corrupt tradition, and not at all from any universal principle that is inbred in nature, such as are those which they have of God's holiness and vindictive justice. And this is the first ground from whence it appears that a real solid discovery of forgiveness is indeed a great work. Many difficulties and hindrances lie in the way of its accomplishment. The next part of John Owen's exposition is called False Presumptions of Forgiveness Discovered, the differences between them and evangelical faith. Before I proceed to produce and manage the remaining evidences of this truth, because what has been spoken lies so obnoxious and open to an objection, which must needs rise in the minds of many, that it may not by this be rendered useless to them, I shall remove it out of the way, that we may pass on to what remains to be said. It will then be said, does not all this lie directly contrary to our daily experience? Do you not find men all full enough, most too full, of apprehensions of forgiveness with God? What so common as, God is merciful, are not the consciences and convictions of the most stifled by this apprehension? Can you find a man that is otherwise minded? Is it not a common complaint that men presume on it to their eternal ruin? Certainly, then, that which all men do, which every man can so easily do, and which you cannot keep men off from doing, though it be to their hurt, has no such difficulty in it as is pretended. And on this very account has this weak endeavor to demonstrate this truth been by some laughed to scorn, men who have taken up them, the teaching of others, but, as it seems, had need to be taught themselves the very first principles of the oracles of God. Answer, all this, then, I say, is so, and much more to this purpose may be spoken. The folly and presumption of poor souls in this can never be enough lamented. But it is one thing to embrace a cloud, a shadow, and another have the truth in reality. I shall, after this, show the true nature of forgiveness and in what it consists, in which the vanity of the self-deceiving will be discovered and laid open. It will appear in the issue that notwithstanding all their pretensions, the most of men know nothing at all, or not anything to the purpose, of that which is under consideration. I shall therefore, for the present, in some few observations, show how far this delusion of many differs from a true gospel discovery of forgiveness, such as that we are inquiring after. First, the common notion of forgiveness that men have in the world is twofold. One, an atheistical presumption on God, that He is not so just and holy, or not just and holy in such a way and manner as He is by some represented. That is the ground of their persuasion of forgiveness. Men think that some declarations of God are fitted only to make them mad, that He takes little notice of these things, and that what He does He will easily pass by, as they suppose, better becomes Him. Come, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die. This is their inward thought. The Lord will not do good, neither will He do evil, which, says the psalmist, is a man thinking that God is such a one as himself, Psalm 50, verse 21, to have no deep nor serious thoughts of His greatness, holiness, purity, severity, but think that He is like themselves, so far as not to be much moved with what they do, what thoughts they have of sin, they think that God has. If with him a slight ejaculation be enough to expiate sin, that their consciences be no more troubled, they think it is enough with God, that it be not punished. The generality of men make light work of sin, and yet in nothing does it more appear what thoughts they have of God. He that has light thoughts of sin has never had great thoughts of God. Indeed, men's undervaluing of sin arises merely from their contempt of God. All sin's concerns flow from its relation to God, and as men's apprehensions are of God, so will they be of sin, which is in opposition to Him. This is the frame of the most of men. They know little of God, and are little troubled about anything that relates to Him. God is not reverenced. Sin is but a trifle. Forgiveness a matter of nothing. Whoso will may have it for asking. But shall this atheistical wickedness of the heart of man be called a discovery of forgiveness? Is not this to make God an idol? He who is not acquainted with God's holiness and purity, who does not know sin's desert and sinfulness, knows nothing of forgiveness. Number two, from the doctrine of the gospel commonly preached and made known, there is a general notion begotten in the minds of men that God is ready to forgive. Men, I say, from this, have a doctrinal apprehension of this truth, without any real satisfactory foundation of that apprehension as to themselves. This they have heard. This they have been told often. So they think, and so they resolve to do. A general persuasion of this spreads itself over all to whom the Son of the Gospel comes. It is not fiducially resolved into the Gospel, but is an opinion growing out of the report of it. Some relief men find by it in the common course of their conversation, in the duties of worship which they perform, as also in their troubles and distresses, whether internal and of conscience or external, and a providence, so that they resolve to retain it. And this is that which I shall briefly speak to. In this manifest the differences between this common prevailing apprehension of forgiveness and faith discovery of it to the soul in its power. 1. That which we reject is loose and general, not fixed, engrafted, or planted on the mind. So is it always where the minds of men receive things only in their notion and not in their power. It lacks fixedness and foundation, which defects accompany all notions of the mind that are only retained in the memory, not implanted in the judgment. They have general thoughts of it, which they use as occasion will serve, to hear that God is a merciful God, and as such they intend to deal with Him. For the true bottom, rise, and foundation of it, whence or on what account to pure and holy God, who will do no iniquity, the righteous God, whose judgment it is that they commit sin or worthy of death, should yet pardon iniquity, transgression, and sin, they don't weigh it. They don't consider it. Or if they do, it is in a slight notional way, as they consider the thing itself. They take it for granted so it is, and never put seriously upon the inquiry how it comes to be so, and that because indeed they have no real concern in it. How many thousands may we meet with who take it for granted that forgiveness is to be had with God, that never yet had any serious exercise in their souls about the grounds of it, and its consistency with His holiness and justice. But those that know it by faith have a sense of it fixed particularly and distinctly on their minds. They have been put upon an inquiry into the rising grounds of it in Christ, so that on a good and unquestionable foundation they can go to God and say, "There is forgiveness with you." They see how and by what means more glory comes to God, by forgiveness and by punishing of sin, which is a manner that the other sort of men are not at all solicitous about. If they may escape punishment, or if they may escape hell, whether God have any glory in their forgiveness or not, for the most part they are indifferent. Number 2. The first apprehension arises without any trial upon inquiry in the consciences of them in whom it is. They have not, by the power of their convictions and distresses of conscience, been put to make inquiry whether the thing be so or not. It is not a persuasion that they have arrived to in a way of seeking satisfaction to their own souls. It is not the result of a deep inquiry after peace and rest. It is antecedent to trial and experience, and so is not faith, but their opinion. For although faith be not experience, yet it is inseparable from it, as is every practical habit. Distresses in their consciences have been prevented by this opinion, but they have not been removed. The reason why the most of men are not troubled about their sins to any purpose is from a persuasion that God is merciful and will pardon, when indeed none can really on a gospel account ordinarily have that persuasion, but those who have been troubled for sin and to that purpose. So is it with them that make this discovery by faith. They have had conflicts in their own spirits, and being deprived of peace, have accomplished a diligent search whether forgiveness were to be obtained or not. The persuasion they have of it, be it more or less, is the issue of a trial they have had in their own souls, of an inquiry how things stood between God and them as to peace and acception of their persons. This is a vast difference. The one sort might possibly have had trouble in their consciences about sin, had it not been for their opinion of forgiveness. This has prevented or stifled their convictions, not healed their wounds, which is a work of the gospel, but kept them from being wounded, which is a work of carnal security. Yea, here lies the ruin of the most of them who perish under the preaching of the gospel. They have received the general notion of pardon. It floats in their minds, and presently presents itself to their relief on all occasions. Does God at any time in the dispensation of the word, under an affliction, upon some great sin against the ruling light, begin to deal with their consciences? Before their conviction can ripen or come to any perfection, before it draw near to its perfect work, they choke it, and heal their consciences with this notion of pardon. Many a man between the assembly and his dwelling house is thus cured. You may see them go away shaking their heads and striking on their breasts, and before they come home be as whole as ever. Well, God is merciful. There is pardon. It's wrought to cure for them. The other sort have obtained their persuasion as a result of the discovery of Christ and the gospel upon a full conviction. Trials they have had, and this is the end of them. Number 3. The one which we reject works no love to God, no delight in Him, no reverence of Him, but rather a contempt and commonness of spirit in dealing with Him. There are none in the world that deal worse with God than those who have an ungrounded persuasion of forgiveness. And if they do fear Him, or love Him, or obey Him in anything, more or less, it is on other motives and considerations, which will not render anything they do acceptable, and not at all on this. As He is good to the creation, they may love. As He is great and powerful, they may fear Him. But sense of pardon, as to any such ends or purposes, has no power upon them. Carnal boldness, formality, and despising of God are the common issues of such a notion and persuasion. Indeed, this is a generation of great sinners in the world, men who have a general apprehension, and not a sense of the special power of pardon. Openly or secretly, in fleshly or spiritual sins, are the great sinners among men, where faith makes a discovery of forgiveness. All things are otherwise. Great love, fear, and reverence of God are its attendants. Mary Magdalene loved much because much was forgiven. Great love will spring out of great forgiveness. There is forgiveness with you, saith the psalmist, that you may be feared. No unbeliever does truly and experimentally know the truth of this inference, but so it is when men fear the Lord and His goodness, Hosea 3:5. I say then, where pardoning mercy is truly apprehended, where faith makes a discovery of it to the soul, it is endeared to God, and possessed of the great springs of love, delight, fear, and reverence. Number 4. This notional apprehension of the pardon of sin begets no serious, thorough hatred and detestation of sin, or is it prevalent to a relinquishment of it? Nay, it rather secretly insinuates into the soul encouragements to a continuance in it. It is the nature of it to lessen and extenuate sin, and to support the soul against its convictions. So Jude tells us that some men turn the grace of God into lasciviousness, verse 4, and he says, they are ungodly men, let them profess what they will, they are ungodly men. But how can they turn the grace of our God into lasciviousness? Is grace capable of a conversion into lust or sin? Will what was once grace ever become wantonness? It is objective, not subjective grace. The doctrine, not the real substance of grace that is intended. The doctrine of forgiveness is this grace of God which may be thus abused. From hence, the men who have only a general notion of it habitually draw secret encouragements to sin and folly. Paul also lets us know that carnal men come into a doctrinal acquaintance with gospel grace are very apt to make such conclusions, Romans 6:1. And it will appear at the last day how unspeakably this glorious grace has been perverted in the soul. It would be well for many if they had never heard the name of forgiveness. It is otherwise where this revelation is received indeed in the soul by believing, Romans 6:14. Our being under grace, under the power of the belief of forgiveness, is our great preservative from our being under the power of sin. Faith of forgiveness is the principle of gospel obedience, Titus 2, verses 11 and 12. Number 5. The general notion of forgiveness brings with it no sweetness, no rest of the soul. Flashes of joy it may, but abiding rest it does not. The truth of the doctrine fluctuates to and fro in the minds of those that have it, but their wills and affections have no solid delight, nor rest by it. Hence, notwithstanding all that profession that is made in the world of forgiveness, do most men ultimately resolve their peace and comfort to themselves, as their apprehensions are of their own doing, good or evil, according to their ruling light, whatever it be. So as to peace and rest, are they secretly tossed up and down. Every one in a several way pleases himself with what he does in answer to his own convictions, and is disquieted as to his state and condition, according as he seems to himself to come short of it. To make a full life of a foundation upon pardon, they don't know how to do it. One duty yields a more true repose than many thoughts of forgiveness, but faith find sweetness and rest in it, being thereby apprehended. It is the only harbor of the soul. It leads a man to God as good, to Christ as rest. Fading, evident joys do oft-times attend the one, but solid delight, with constant obedience, are the fruits only of the other. Number 6. Those who have the former only take up their persuasion on false grounds, though the thing itself be true, and they cannot but use it to false ends and purposes. Besides this natural and genuine tendency, for the grounds they will be discovered when I come to treat of the true nature of gospel forgiveness. For the end, it is used generally only to fill up what is lacking. Self-righteousness is their bottom, and when that is too short or narrow to cover them, they piece it out by forgiveness, where conscience accuses us must supply the defect. Faith lays it on its proper foundation, of which afterwards also, and it uses it to its proper end, namely, to be the sole and only ground of our exception with God. That is the proper use of forgiveness, that all may be of grace, for when the foundation is pardon, the whole superstructure must needs be grace. From what has been spoken, it is evident that notwithstanding the pretenses to the contrary, insinuated in the objection now removed, it is a great thing to have gospel forgiveness discovered to a soul in a saving manner.